My name is Arlene, and I am an alcoholic.
Arlene.
Brought my own drink, and they had one here for me. That's measured to how long I can speak and not have to go to the restroom. You know, when I got this call, when Jesse first called me, I was over in Laughlin, Nevada, with one of my daughters gambling, which I like to do. I can do that today. And I was really shocked when I came back and had this message as they wanted me to speak in Kansas City. And partially, I'll tell you why. You know, there's a story in AA about speakers are someone that will travel 2,000 miles to speak, but they won't go across the street to go to a meeting. And I hope I'm not too much of a disappointment, because I'm not a speaker. I'm a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. I go across the street all the time to meetings. I was told when I got here that if I drank every day, I should go to a meeting every day. And I've done that almost fully in the 22 years I've been sober. My AA birthday is May 9th, 1969. It's a year I can remember. It's also a number I like. Give you some idea of what you can expect here. You know, I would tell you something about Barbara, but I didn't come here to talk about Barbara. I came here to speak about Arlene and my sobriety, my experience, strength, and hope. And hopefully you came here to listen. I just hope you don't get finished before I do. I have enough trouble staying in my own story sometimes. You know, I listen to all these speakers, and I'm waiting to get a good story to tell. And then it dawns on me, you know, again, one more time, that I have a story of my own to tell. And I'll try to tell you as much as I can. I brought my watch up here, and the program says I only have to speak until 8:30. So I'm not real sure how I'm going to manage to get 17 years of drinking and 22 years of sobriety into 15 minutes, but if I run a little over that, I will know when you're nodding off, because sometimes I get hypnotized by the sound of my voice and don't know when to quit anyway. So there's also another great story I heard, and I was asking Gary early about tapes of Franklin. He tells a story about the greatest messenger carrier in the whole world was Paul Revere. He had one message to carry, and that's all he carried. You know, he rode around and said, "The British are coming, the British are coming." He didn't stop at every farm and tell them how to plant or what their daughters were doing, or what religion they should be into. He just had that one message. And no matter what I tell you tonight, the message really is the only message that I have and that I've gotten from Alcoholics Anonymous, is that no matter what, I don't drink, and Alcoholics Anonymous works if I live it. It doesn't say how, it says how it works. And it works if I live it, I found out. And I don't have, like I said, I don't have a pitch that goes right along like some people do. Mine jumps around to wherever my mind happens to be at the time. So I will tell you, I've already told you, I've drank 17 years. I drank straight vodka most of that 17 years, because I tried whiskey and I got sick. And I never drank whiskey again. I didn't like the taste of it. And I tried gin, and I sat and drank gin one night in a bar when I was 19 with a mother-in-law whose name was Doodoo, a rough little woman. She challenged me to see which of us could go with the bartender, and she was somewhere in her 50s, and I was about 18, and I drank gin, and I went to stand up, and fell flat in my face. So I never drank gin again, because I knew it would interfere in my sex life. You know, some messages I got quicker than others. But I found vodka was my drink. Of course, we all know it doesn't smell. And nobody knows you're drinking it if you're a vodka drinker. And then towards the last of my drinking, the last 7 years of my drinking, I was living down in Texas at the time when you bought your own bottle and carried it around to the bars and just bought your setups. And I found this wonderful cherry-flavored vodka that was 180 proof. And, you know, if people didn't look real close, they saw that cherry color and they'd think it was wine. So not too many ever asked me to share my alcohol, which was fine with me. And those few that did never asked me again for some strange reason. And I thought I was a controlled drinker. I bought my booze by the case, which was fairly usual down in Texas if you could afford it, and I could at the time. And I always limited myself pretty much to a fifth a day, except when my husband and I sometimes shared a fifth some days. I don't really know exactly why, but I know that happened occasionally, and we had this ritual thing where we would play different card games or cribbage or something, and whoever lost would have to run to the store to get the milk for the day because we weren't going to invest in a lot of food. You know, there were other things more important, the alcohol. And I would usually lose, but not always. And one particular night I'd been playing cards with him and I had lost and there was a little bit of the bottle left, so I wanted to rush off to get the milk and get back before he got to finish his bottle. And I rushed off in the car and I went to the closest grocery store by us, and it happened to be at that time down in Texas most of the little grocery stores were like garages with garage doors on the front. Except this one Japanese fella, and he'd saved his money, and he had made this beautiful grocery store with a huge plate glass windows all across the front. It was unusual for Texas at that time. And I'm rushing down there, and my husband happened to be a mechanic, and he never worked on anything we owned. So I pulled into the parking lot, and no brakes. And I went right through this guy's plate glass window. And I'm right there by his little checkout stand. And he's standing there in shock. And I rolled down the window. I reached over. He's on the passenger side. And I rolled down the window. And I couldn't think of anything to say. But I'd had a few drinks, you know, all most of this bottle anyway, my share of it. And I looked at him and I said, "Remember Pearl Harbor." You know, I always thought I was a friendly drunk, too. When I got to the program, I told everybody I was a friendly drunk, and I thought I was friendly. I didn't, you know, like most people, it took me a couple years to figure out who I really was. And what I did when I was drinking down there in Texas is that I carried a Derringer over and under Magnum. Pistol in one pocket, and I carried a Beretta with a spare clip in the other. And I weighed 240 pounds when I was drinking, too, by the way. And, you know, I heard somebody earlier say something referred to if they couldn't get away from her, they were fucked for the night or something close to that anyway. And that's was me. No, not too many people said no to me. When I first got to the program, I thought I was a great piece of ass. I thought it was the only value I had. And it took me 2 years of inventories to figure out I was an available piece of ass, and there was a big difference. Something about me, too, that I had 9 children. I did not come here gay. I came here bisexual. I always blamed having 9 children on non-smoking. But I was sharing with somebody today about when I was pregnant with my ninth child. I was only 27 years old, and my doctor asked me to have my husband come in with me to talk to him, and we got there, and as usual, I'd had a few drinks, and he looked at my husband, and he said, "You have to get fixed. This woman is going to die if she gets pregnant again." And I looked right back at him, and I said, "What in the hell good is that going to do me?" So anyway, I have friends of my own, even then. I told you I jump around my story a lot. I did have nine children, and I did get fixed, and I didn't come home for 3 weeks. You know, some people say it changes you. It did me. I was in Kansas City, Kansas, 2 years ago, and I came here to see a daughter of mine. I had my first two children. My first husband called my father and offered to sell them to him. He had run off with them, and I was 19 years old and drinking pretty heavy, and my father had a little money, a lot of money, and this man called my father and offered to sell the children to him. He didn't want them, but he wanted some money, and he thought he could get it out of my dad. And my dad threatened to have him thrown in jail, and he disappeared with my two children. My daughter was 2.5 years old at the time, and I feel like I'm talking to nobody out there. Sorry. I'll be cross-eyed before I'm done talking. Anyway, he disappeared with these two children. My daughter was 2.5. My son was 5 months old. And I came to see my daughter, whom I hadn't seen in 30 years. And I've talked to a couple people this weekend who have had problems with relating to their children and different kinds of problems, possibly. But I was 20 years old before I saw this daughter. My children have taught me a lot of lessons. I have six living children. I have one son who has AIDS. He lives down in Louisiana with his lover, and they've been together 12 years. And I'm going to regress back to my childhood a little. Partly what had a lot of effect on my drinking and on my sobriety is when I was a very young child, I was sexually molested by my mother. And my mother was a practicing alcoholic, and she did little games with me, like tie my hands together and hang me on a coat hook naked and leave me hanging like that, and then crawl in the room and jump up in front of me and scream at me. And while I was hanging there, she also did little things like put diaper pins through my body in different places and pull on them so that blood would run down my body. And when it would dry, she would drag me into a hot shower so it would bleed again. And my mother died in my bedroom door in a pool of blood when I was 5 years old. And because of that experience in sobriety, I've had the opportunity to go through some therapy and learn about dual personalities, multiples, or splitting, whatever you may or may not identify with. I created and developed a lot of personalities. I did a lot of out-of-body experiences as a child because of the pain I went through. And I had to relive a lot of that pain in sobriety to learn how to live. And because of that, one of my favorite words today is the word feeling. And in the dictionary, and some of you were at the workshop I did this morning, so please bear with me, don't quickly before I get finished with the rest of it. But anyway, I like this word, and I like explaining why it has so much to do with my sobriety. It comes from words from German and Latin that mean prepare to touch and palm of the hand. And if you touch the palm of your hand, you will feel the sensitivity. If you continue touching it, it will become painful. If you continue touching it, it will become numb. And when I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, my feelings were numb. And what happened for me is I had the ability to learn how to feel through the processing of the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I got to feel the numbness. I got to experience the pain. And I got to experience the sensitivity. And then I got to have the sense to stop feeling so damn much. Because as I said this morning, I love to suffer. I had so much practice at suffering. You know, I was a habitual victim. I loved suffering. And Alcoholics Anonymous taught me so much on that. When I first came in and stuff started coming up, I went to 11 meetings a week. By the end of the week, when I had shared my poor me, I had the Al-Anon salute for you that don't know. Not only was everybody in the room sick and tired of my story, so was I. So if you're suffering and you're getting sick and tired of it, that's okay. It's okay. It's fairly normal. It's fairly normal in Alcoholics Anonymous to come in and feel your feelings and walk through them. And I got to do all the drinking I could do. I got to do all my share. There are people in gay AA that said I not only had my share of children, I had their share of children. I have some really good relationships with my children today. As a matter of fact, I gave my youngest daughter a one-year cake in NA in July. And this daughter is a real special gift, like all my children are to me. She, when she was doing drugs and alcohol, she used to call me up and threaten me. You know, like, don't go out of your house, I'm going to kill you. And I wasn't real sure because having drank myself, I knew this possibility, she was thinking of it. So, and I had done a few things in my drinking that were not real kind to my children, and I had the opportunity to live through those experiences and learn to make an amends to myself and to my children. Amends means to change for the better, and it's a slow process to get to that changing, you know, to jump up there to the eighth and ninth step. You know, it's like the character defects things. I like to say if it wasn't for my defects of character, I would not have had any character at all when I got here, you know. So thank God it was a slow process. If I'd known what I was going to have to face and walk through, like most of us, I wouldn't have stayed to walk through it, and thank God we don't know. I did not know most of the things that I have had to face. I had to go into intense group therapy and hypnosis when I was a year sober to deal, because I had this mental image of my mother laying in a pool of blood for 27 years. I saw it day and night, drunk or sober, all the time. And I was fortunate enough to be led to a program that worked for me and helped me through that, where I've not seen that image since going through that. But I know I couldn't have walked through it without sobriety. I also did not deal with the incest issues themselves until I was almost 11 years sober before I started dealing with the incest issues and the dual personalities. So, you know, God never has given me more than I can handle, but of course his idea of what I can handle and mine have never matched either. So Yeah, I like to say, I think in AA we get a God that matches our personality. And if you haven't recognized it yet, I have a sick personality. And I got a God that matched my personality perfectly. So I get to, you know, I get as much as I grow into, too, which is kind of scary sometimes, too. Some years ago I wrote a thing about responsibility is the price that I pay for self-respect. And that's led to some other thinking in the program that one of the things that I personally have experienced is that I had to go through almost everything I did drunk sober. And it had a lot to do with feelings. I don't say that that's necessary for anybody else. One of the things I like about the history of Alcoholics Anonymous is they found that for alcoholics, we broke away from the Oxford group specifically because they were into absolutes. And with alcoholics, there are no absolutes. We're all exactly what we are, which reminds me, and I probably stopped in the middle of telling you something, but that's too bad. what I did think about was just before I came up here, I called my mother, and because she calls me and she hates getting my answering machine. So I want to remind her that I would not be in town this weekend, so don't call. And I said, now, you know I'm going to Kansas City to a convention. And she says, yes, oh, yes, you're speaking. She said, did you go shopping? And I said, no, Mother, I didn't go shopping. I get to go as myself, so I don't have to shop. I can't wear what, you know, my own clothes. And she says, well, what are you wearing? And I mentioned the leather pants, and she said, oh, my God. She says, that doesn't sound appropriate to speak in. And I said, Mother, it's a gay conference. She says, well, why don't they have a man speak? I said, Mother, I'm a lesbian. I said, and I didn't get that way alone. And I want to tell you, you've got some great-looking women here in Kansas City. Some of the men aren't too bad either, even though I'm not into that. Despite what I've said about 9 children, I haven't had to go to bed with a man for 19 years. You know, I used to think that I drank so I could have sex with men. When I first got to Alcoholics Anonymous, that's what I thought. And it took my first inventory actually was a suicide note. Well, at least it started out as a suicide note and got into an inventory finally. And what I found out is that I'd been having, I thought I was drinking to have sex with women because I was bisexual. And what I found out with 2.5 years of sobriety that I was drinking to have sex with men. And it was like, if you quit having sex with men, you won't have to drink. Yeah, maybe. That's part of it. I don't know about you, but it was more than one thing that got me here. My third step tells me that. It's a symptom of the disease, the drinking. And I haven't I did go out with one man one time after my first lover. You know, I like to share not too much about my drinking. You know I drank. If you want to know more about my drinking, I'll talk to you on a one-to-one. I drank. I qualify. When I got here, I'd been through quite a few institutions, couple marriages, several children, and a couple lovers. And, you know, it's just this, was as sick as I possibly could get at that time and still be alive. And when I got here, I'd also tried to kill myself 16 times. And I'd been pronounced dead 3 of those times. And I know today that there's no mistake that I'm still alive. I almost hurt myself, you know. You get dangerous out there in that condition. And I've had a couple friends that I think accidentally killed themselves, you know, in that attempt to get attention, to get help. And I wanted and needed help, and I didn't know how else to ask. And that was the best I could do before I got here. And it's been a slow process learning how to ask for that help since. But one night I had this great dream. I dreamt I was depressed and suicidal and several years sober. And I dreamt that I had jumped off the Coronado Bridge, which is kind of a gathering spot for suicide in our community. And I jumped off the Coronado Bridge, and it's this dream, and this big booming voice came out and said, "Arlene, I was going to change it." Change in the dictionary means made different. Made in the dictionary means not occurring naturally. Had me hooked after I read that. I like doing things that aren't natural. At least that's what I've been told. So, anyway, I use the dictionary a lot. It saved my life in more than one incident. And I love that, you know, that Bill used the dictionary. And I also found out that Dr. Bob read a book called The Greatest Thing in the World by Henry Drummond. And it's about love. And their description of love, to me, is like a description of what Alcoholics Anonymous was like when I came in. The giving, the concern, the reaching out, the dignity that I got to keep when I got here. Nobody tried to fix me. They shared their experience, strength, and hope with me and allowed me to make my own mistakes, which is a paradox. And paradox means contrary to expectations. The paradox is there are no mistakes. There are no negatives. There are only things I haven't learned yet. Nothing happens that isn't God's will in my life. Nothing happens that isn't God's will. I don't know why this comes in right behind that, but I have a son that has AIDS. I have a son that went to the Gulf. He left on the day the war started. And I remember talking to somebody who was concerned about the brother who had gone over, and I said, how could I possibly be concerned if I can turn my will in life over the care of God? How could I not turn my son's will in life over the care of God? And that's true for both of my sons. My son is back from the Gulf. He didn't get back until the end of July, but he is back safe. And my other son has been diagnosed for 8 years. He's been with his lover for 12 years. He lives down in Louisiana. There was no clinics that he was comfortable with, so he drove 4 hours to go either to Mississippi or New Orleans or somewhere in Mississippi, I forget where he said, but it was a 4-hour drive one way to get to a clinic to get some therapy. But again, you know, I've shared with my son, so I will share with you that it's in my will how I'm going to die, what's going to happen to me when I die, actually. And this came about because I had tried to arrange my funeral. I tried to be responsible because since I'm into suffering so much, you know, I was into dying. I don't know about anybody else, but every time I'm going to have surgery or fly, I think about it, you know. And I know most of you don't relate to that, but I do. And so it's in my will that I'm going to be cremated because I couldn't find a funeral parlor that would do me bare-ass naked, face down with carnation in my ass, you know. I'm not going if I can't have fun. So I am going to be cremated, and my ashes will be mixed with douche powder and sent to all my ex-lovers. Except for one, she wants hers with mouthwash. And those that don't take it, it's going to be scattered over our local F Street bookstore, which is a dirty bookstore, in case you didn't recognize that. You may not have F Street bookstores here. I got to laugh at some things. You know, I don't know anybody that's going to get out of here alive, and I'm just going to have as much fun as I can about it. Before I go, I like to share mostly about my sobriety, and I started to tell you that before because most of you know how to drink, but what I like to share is how my experience, strength, and hope in surviving Alcoholics Anonymous. There are a lot of people here that don't have any sense of humor. You know? And I take my sobriety serious. I wouldn't have it if I didn't. I like your conference theme of the freedom to choose, and I choose to have a good time. And I choose to accept all the experiences that God's given me as gifts from God. I have to tell you, when I was new, I was dyslexic when I came in the program. And when I came in the program, since I had a lot of sexual issues and a lot of sexual problems, I asked somebody, an old-timer in the program, where you find out about how to handle sexual issues in the big book. And they were very informative, and they told me page 69. If you didn't know that, you know, hopefully it's a number you can't forget either. But anyway, being dyslexic, I didn't remember that. And I don't know if any of you have ever read page 96. Do not be discouraged if your prospect does not respond at once. Search out another alcoholic and try again. Wait a minute. Shh. This is the punchline. You've got to hear the punchline. You are sure to find someone desperate enough to accept with eagerness what you offer. Of course this program's for me. I'll give up anything for this ideal. Fit right in with the rest of mine. And I don't know about anybody else, but when I did my sexual inventory, I counted everybody I had sex with sober. And I had what I call a fair let's. That's one night or less. And I counted them. I mean, they were valid, and some of them were even good. And last November, I bought a computer for myself. I still have all these children and grandchildren, and I have a tendency to spend all my money on them. I still have a little codependency problem here. But I had counted up what I'd spent on my kids in the last couple years, and I knew I could afford a computer. I just knew if I didn't go ahead and buy it on credit, I wouldn't get it. So I went ahead and bought a computer, which I did pay off in 3 months. But it's wonderful. You know, I didn't know absolutely anything about computers when I bought this. I'd never touched one. I'd never really looked at one before I bought this one. But you can slide in anywhere and change it and put stuff in it. And mine has a dictionary, which I use a lot, pulls down these great bits of information about what I'm bullshitting about or whatever. And so I put all 35 of my lovers, and that's including the woman I'm dating now, in this computer. And to the guys, that's nothing. That's a one-night stand somewhere, you know. To the women, I don't intend to shock you. I just intend to tell you my truth, my story. And I know that it relates today to a lot of my issues, because a couple things that have happened to me in sobriety. One is that when I was 10 years sober, I was in a relationship I should not have been in. But I'm not going to listen to God. I mean, I'm into suffering. What else? God knows I wasn't going to let her be happy and leave. And God has his way with me, if I want it or not. And we were out fishing, and I slipped on an embankment about a foot and a half and totally shattered my right ankle. Broke every bone in the ankle that came out both sides of my foot. I spent like 7 hours in surgery. Before they took me to surgery, everybody in the hospital came down to look at the x-rays. I knew something was going on here. I spent 3 months in a wheelchair. During that 3 months in a wheelchair, I got to meeting every single day. Because, you know, if I was drinking, I would have got to a bar every single day. And I remembered what they told me. If I put half as much into my sobriety as I put into my drinking, I just might make it. I managed to get to a meeting every day of the 3 months I was in that wheelchair, and I managed to decide that if I was going to be in that kind of pain, I would walk normal, because they told me I'd be crippled. And I did what the program gave me, some skills on communicating with a higher power, and I spirit in the dictionary means to breathe. Sometimes I forget to do that, especially in circumstances like this. Anyway, I psyched myself up and taught myself how to walk again. And I walked into his office 6 months later, and he came out of a room as I was coming down the hall, and he started crying. He said, "You can't walk like that." And I've had 4 surgeries on my foot. They've gone in both sides of my foot, and if I showed you that, you probably, most of you can't even see the scar. I don't know why. I just know that's part of the gift I've gotten in sobriety. You know, when they said fringe benefits, I thought it was money, property, and prestige, but that's the fringe benefits. I also had a vaginal hysterectomy, in case anybody's interested in seeing that scar. And 4 years ago, but, you know, I got messages. I needed to slow down. I needed to get out of that relationship. The woman, we had quite a problem. I got choked unconscious, ended up wearing turtlenecks because I didn't want to admit to absolutely everybody how. She was 6 years sober. I was 10 years sober at the time. Got out of that relationship. Now, some of this stuff you may find rather bizarre, but I may not remember to give you the points of all of it, but there was a point for me in all of it. When I got out of that relationship, I was afraid I'd go back. And I'd always wanted to do something rather spiritual, which I had a problem with in the program of finding a God of my understanding. And if you want to know about that, I guess you'll have to buy the workshop tape, because I'm not going back into that. What I did, I decided that with 10 years sobriety on New Year's Eve, I decided to shave my head. I thought that was a rather spiritual kind of ideal, and it was before it was popular for women to shave their heads even. I mean, I was 10 years sober, and I was afraid I'd go back to this woman, and I thought, God, you know, nobody's going to want me with a shaven head. And if it's too embarrassing or painful, the worst that can happen is I'll stay home and read all those books I'm procrastinating about. You know, so I went to a Halloween party in a black velvet pantsuit with a hood and pulled the hood back at appropriate times to shock the hell out of people. And I don't know about you, but I am the kind of person that if I offend and shock and get certain reactions from people, I continue to do it. So I shaved my head for 3 months. You know, I may be sober, but I'm not totally well in some areas, obviously. But one of the neat things that came out of this for me is my sponsor had 35 years of sobriety, and I did some cleaning for her, and I was over at her house, and she had already heard, of course, this, you know how nothing goes out of AA meetings, but occasionally something slips by, and she had heard, and I came over to her house and had a stocking cap on. She informed me she had heard, and she came right up in my face. She's a little bitty woman, and she said, "Arlene, what's the matter with you?" The strangest thing happened when she said that. I was 10 years sober, and for the very first time in my life, I knew that somebody was looking at my outsides, and I knew that she did not truly know my insides, but I did. And the God of my understanding helped me understand that. And I grew a lot from that. And I continued to shave my head, mind you. I wasn't that well or over it. And I met a woman during that period of time. And she took me home to meet her mother during that period of time. I should have known that relationship was not going to work. And, well, anyway, think about it. Obviously, I let my hair grow. I like something to hang on to, too. I'm sick, you know, they didn't tell you that. I better tell you a little bit about what I know about the program of Alcoholics Anonymous before you really freak out. I know people have got done listening already. That or we're all headed for the restroom shortly. I don't know what. I do need a sip of water here. Relationships have taught me a lot. 4 years ago, I got in a relationship with a woman I was very much aware was very sick mentally and emotionally. And during the process of this relationship, she told a therapist that I was verbally abusive to her and physically abusive to her. Now, I wear leather because I like leather. I'm not into S&M. I'm sorry. You know, I wore this leather to... I threatened to send around a picture. I've got a picture of me in leather at an AA dance. That should be good enough to anybody to see, shouldn't it? Does somebody want to come up and get this picture? I want it back, I hope. One of the guys, watch the guys. They'll keep this picture. Barbara? anyway, I went to an AA dance in leather, a Halloween dance, mind you, and people keep thinking that I'm into S&M, and I'm not, but the word got around. This woman was saying that I was. So in therapy, I agreed not to raise my hands to her. Now, I'm a sick alcoholic, and so one night when we weren't agreeing, and she started beating me, I remembered that I wasn't to raise my hands to her. And I sat there until the woman beat me unconscious. This is like 4 years ago. I'm 18 years sober. But it was a gift from God, because all these years and all the therapy I've gone through, I could never understand. Intellectually, I knew that I didn't cause my mother to do the things to me she did. Intellectually, it was perfectly clear that it wasn't my fault. But my mother had told me it was. And it wasn't until this woman beat me up and then told me it was my fault that she had beat me that I knew in my heart and in my gut the truth. So there are no mistakes. God sends us the messengers and the messages that we need. And I needed that message because I had suffered a long, long time with the other message. Today I am free, free enough to share it. What happened for me was 2 months later, I realized I was blind in my left eye. And I went to a doctor, and sure enough, I was blind. The center of my eye was bleeding. The retina had detached. I was fortunate enough one more time to be able to have laser surgery. I did get back some of the sight in my left eye, but I did not get all of it back. But I got a greater gift. I got freedom. You talk about your freedom to choose. I never would have chosen that. God does not send me anything I do not need, because I am free from something I'd carried for a long, long time. I hear a lot of speakers talk about self-worth and self-respect. And one of the things I wrote several years ago for myself was that responsibility is the price I pay for self-respect. Another relationship where I got a great lesson. I hear a lot of topics about guilt. You know, a lot of people are into guilt and suffering. As I said this morning, I was going to sell inflatable crosses because we love to suffer so much, you know. I was in a relationship again with somebody else, and she was supposed to move, and I left for 10 days so she could move. And I came back, and she's still there. And she tried to make me feel guilty about her problems, her personal problems. And I remember standing out in the yard and talking to her, and I said, you know, I'm willing to be responsible for my part in things today. Alcoholics Anonymous has taught me no matter what to look at my part. And I'm willing to be responsible for my part in things, but I am not willing to be guilty. And for me, out of my writing at that period of time, I was able to write about guilt. And what I've come to believe for me is that guilt is my ego. It's easing God out. It's not allowing myself the time or energy to look at my part in it and to see if I am in fact guilty of something I need to be responsible for. And I found a new way of life in this. But this is the process of Alcoholics Anonymous. Alcoholics Anonymous has given me all kinds of freedom. I've lost my glasses. I took them off and can't find them. I'm going to try to wind this up here a little bit. I hear a lot of people talking about the phrase KISS. Because I got my dignity back in Alcoholics Anonymous, I no longer consider KISS to mean keep it simple, stupid. I sign birthday cards with the word KISS, but I write out what it means to me today. It means keep it simple spiritually. Because that's the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. It's full of spirit and feeling. Sometimes people do things that I don't like. But today I'm able to separate what people do from the people. Because the people in Alcoholics Anonymous have been able to separate what I do from me. The picture that's going along around is me, obviously. Pretty bare facts there, ain't it? This side of the room doesn't know what we're talking about. Whenever I speak, I have two shirts, one of two shirts that I wear for a particular reason. The shirt I have on tonight, it's rolled up at the sleeves because it's a size bigger than I should wear, or maybe two sizes bigger than what I would normally wear. I wear this shirt to remind me not to get too big for my shirt or my shit here, you know, my bullshit. I have another shirt. It's a black silk shirt, and it has a burn right up here in front in that shirt. It doesn't show unless you're real close. Sorry I didn't wear it. I wear that shirt when I speak to remind me I'm not perfect. And it has a lot to do with something an old-timer gave me when I got here. He talked about the difference between value and worth. He said a zipper doesn't have a whole lot of value, but if it's in the right place and it's working, it's got a lot of worth. And as a sober alcoholic, sometimes when I don't think I have a lot of value, the people in Alcoholics Anonymous taught me about worth, taught me about self-worth, taught me that if I live this program, the program works. I don't work the program. I never did work the program. I don't know how to work the program. I know how to live it. And I know how to live it because a few things I found in the books of Alcoholics Anonymous and the people of Alcoholics Anonymous. And one of them is the third paragraph in the foreword of the 12 and 12. There's a line in there, and I never quote it perfect. And I don't quote it perfect because I don't remember it, and also because I hope some of you will look for it. It says, AA's 12 steps are a group of principles, spiritual in nature, which if practiced will lead to a happy and whole life and expel the obsession for alcohol. I had to get out the dictionary. You know, I didn't know what a principle was when I got to Alcoholics Anonymous. It's a basic truth. A basic truth. I didn't want to know that either, because you had a lot of them here that I didn't particularly want to practice. I found that the steps to me are like a combination lock, and I talked about this some this morning. But I can't talk about me and the program of Alcoholics Anonymous without talking about how I learned it, what it means to me, and some of these little... You know, I had a lot of games going when I drank, so it was... Again, with this God of my understanding, it was obvious I was going to have to create some games if I was going to survive myself. I have literally stayed sober despite Arlene more than anybody else. And after Arlene, it's you, the people in Alcoholics Anonymous, because not everybody liked me. You know, I drank, I didn't like everybody either. What a concept, you know? But the people did teach me that I could love you. And that's what I learned how to do. And love to me means trust, respect, and caring. And I found that through Alcoholics Anonymous, it's so many paradoxes over and over. Love means God. The book tells me I'll find God deep within myself. Because I've practiced these principles to the best of my ability, I am today able to love Arlene. I live alone, but when I go home, there's going to be somebody there that loves me. And I couldn't always say that. I couldn't say that for a long time. I've wanted to drink. I've wanted to die in Alcoholics Anonymous in my sobriety because I've hurt. The worst pain I have has not been the surgeries I've had. Those somehow I know I'll heal from. The worst pains I've had are the emotional ones. And sometimes it's not because of what somebody said to me, but because what I thought they were thinking of me. You know, I remember when I was 10 years sober, and a lot of things happened to me in my 10th year, obviously. It was just before I shaved my head. And this woman came to my house, and you know, people came to my house, and we talked, and we talked. And she finally left, and... She was the ex-lover of a baby of mine, and about 15 minutes later, she came back and knocked on my door. And she said, "Arlene, why didn't you take me to bed?" I had been talking like I took everybody to bed. I'd been treating myself with the old ideas. And what I found out from that is that I, a lot of times still, not so much today because I'm aware of it, judged myself by what I thought that I never did. What a waste of time. I have enough trouble looking at what I did, let alone worrying about what I never did. But I spent a lot of years doing that and paying that penalty inside. So I'm going to go a little bit through the steps and through the process. When I sponsor people, I ask them not to go beyond the third step for the first year and a half. It's not a requirement. If they're ready and they do it, it's fine. Do any of the other steps, it's fine. There are no absolutes for me with anybody. But I suggest that they try that, the first three steps for the first year and a half. What I've found is that anybody I've sponsored that has done that, I can sit down with them at the end of the year and a half and show them and verbally tell them where they have, in fact, lived some portion of every one of the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. You know how I got this amazing information? Maybe I shouldn't tell you. You'd think I'm pretty smart right now, huh? Anyway, how I got that was that it dawned on me that they didn't write these steps and then live them. They lived these steps and then wrote them. And the chances are, if you don't drink for a year and a half, you're going to do some portion of each one of the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. It's just amazing how that happens. It can happen to me, and what you've known about me, you know it can happen for you. Not to worry. The HOW, the first step being honesty. I lie to myself before I lie to anybody else. Didn't like finding that out. Some of you would be sorry I told that. Try to forget it sometimes. For me, there's a step before the first step, and it's called denial. And whenever I'm in trouble today, I'm at step one. I'm in some kind of denial. I'm not being honest about my part in something. Honesty is the first step to my sobriety. I had to reach a point. I'm a relapser, by the way. I came into the program of Alcoholics Anonymous in 1968 and drank at 6-month intervals. My first drunk was really amazing. I was through the book. I'd read everything. I knew everything. Some of us are quicker than others. And I decided to go out and make an amends to a woman who I had slept with her boyfriend. And, of course, I knew these people were still drinking when I went there. And my idea of an amends turned out to be going to bed with both of them, you know. Obviously, I needed to do some more reading. Anyway, I like to point out that I'm a relapser, and now I do have 22 years of continuous sobriety in case you're a relapser and have some concerns about it. It doesn't mean you can't make it. I found that first of all, I found that by the time I got to the second step the first few times, that I quit working it on my drinking. I was working it on everything and everybody else but my drinking, and I had to keep going back. And for some reason, it reminds me of an old girlfriend. She was really rough. I had some rough girlfriends in my drinking. She had a vibrator. She had a kickstart. Fond memories. Anyway, by the time I got to the second step and the spiritual principle there, now those really fit, don't they? Spiritual principle there was open-mindedness. Have any of you ever broken an egg? How many of you have ever put one back together? You know what I found that the second step said to me is no matter what I'd done, I couldn't change it. And to be open-minded about accepting it. And that helped me get through the fear of everything that had happened in my life. But I found there was another spiritual principle involved for me in the second step that was really important. And it was the principle of forgiveness. And in the dictionary, forgiveness means to no longer require a penalty be paid. That was my problem. I kept not forgiving myself. How could I be open-minded and let go when I was into all this suffering? I had to forgive myself. And I found that it still doesn't work one without the other. I am truly not being open-minded if I haven't truly forgiven myself for something that's already done. I cannot change the past. But I can look at my part because of Alcoholics Anonymous and do what I need to do to make amends. The third step, this spiritual principle of willingness. God, I was willing to do anything before I got here. Why shouldn't I be after I got here? For me, that goes backwards. I take back my will, then I become God again, and then I'm into my life is unmanageable. It always goes back that way, but I just manage not to get into the drinking. To me, the spiritual principle of acceptance is in those first three steps and those five spiritual principles that I found there. Honesty, open-mindedness, forgiveness, willingness, humility. Humility for me is accepting that no matter what happens in my life is exactly what God wants to happen in my life. Exactly what God wants to happen in my life. There are no mistakes. I told you a few of the things that happened in my life that were gifts, that if I would have been given the choice, I would have never chosen. That the God of my understanding, the God that I found in Alcoholics Anonymous, the God that I found in my dictionary, by the way, I chose the description, the chief object of my affections. It's in my dictionary under God. Because I know that I have the ability to make people, places, and things the chief object of my affection real easy, real quick, real fast. And so keeping that awareness that when I know that I live my life for somebody else's needs, happiness, that I have gotten away from my God. Because I found God deep within myself just as the book told me I would. And if someone loves me and cares about me, they aren't offended by me taking care of myself. And I certainly don't want to take care of anybody today. And I'm not offended by somebody taking care of themselves. I'm not going on into the rest of the steps. I've already gone past my allotted time, I believe. I do want to thank you for one of the great gifts of Alcoholics Anonymous. You have listened me into existence. Thank you.